From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the October 2019 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast. Early days. Gas masks are to be taken. So ends what seems a rather mundane government memo dated the 2nd of August 1939. Its importance becomes apparent when you discover this was the move order sent to the staff of the Government Code and Cipher School. As Hitler threatened Poland, it seemed another war in Europe was inevitable, so it was decided the staff of GCNCS should move to their war station in the Buckinghamshire countryside. With hindsight, we now know that over the next 6 long years, Bletchley Park would become a code-breaking factory, but what were those early days really like? In this It Happened Here episode, Bletchley Park's research officer, Dr. Thomas Cheetham, takes us back to August 1939, and through documents held in the archives, tells the story of the arrival at Bletchley and dispels a few myths along the way. Special thanks to Mr. Ben Thompson for voicing our archival documents.
This is Bletchley Park. It happened here.
Tom, this episode looks at the early days of codebreaking at Bletchley Park, but it's not actually the first time the codebreakers were here, is it?
No, the park had been purchased in early 1938, and the codebreakers had actually come for the first time later that year, in September, around the time of the Munich crisis. And this was a mobilisation to war. Contrary to popular perception, it wasn't a test, it wasn't a visit to check out the suitability of the site. It was a reaction to the fact that war was expected to break out over Czechoslovakia. So the codebreakers in the end stayed for about 3 weeks.
And this is what's known as Captain Ridley's shooting party.
Yeah, that's correct. And we talked about this a bit last year over the anniversary.
At the end of Captain Ridley's shooting party, did everybody leave and only come back at the outbreak of war?
Well, okay, so the codebreakers have gone back to London. Chamberlain's returned from Munich with his scrap of paper, assuring peace in our time. So it seems like the crisis has been averted and war isn't going to break out. So the Government Code and Cipher School returned to London. But that doesn't mean Bletchley Park lies empty. It's still being worked on as a communications centre. Those lessons which have been learned during the shooting party, especially about the state of the communications, they start to be put right. It's important to remember that the site is not just for the Government Code and Cipher School. It's the war station for the Secret Intelligence Service, SIS, who we now know as MI6. So there are a certain number of staff still here renovating the site, improving the communications, getting it ready for a possible conflict in the future. And there's also a common misconception that the famous huts only started being built after the outbreak of war. But again, that's not true. And something that was going on in the meantime was a certain number of huts were built here. So we've actually got a letter in the archives sent to the Treasury Valuer by Captain Ridley himself, who was the Chief Administrative Officer here. He's telling the people in charge of valuing government property how they've actually changed the site since they took it over. And he informs the Valuer that there was a hut occupied in April 1939, another in May, two huts occupied in August 1939. And further huts built since the outbreak of war.
So there's quite a lot of activity going on site, actually, before war was even declared. What was happening that might be leading people to come to this conclusion that the war station needed to be built up?
So the Munich Agreement appears to solve the crisis, and it appears that peace will reign for the foreseeable future. But come 1939, it becomes increasingly apparent that that's not going to be the case. Hitler still has ambitions for the rest of Czechoslovakia that he hasn't yet occupied. And in the end, Germany invades in March 1939. And this is the point where Chamberlain, I think, realises his policy of appeasement isn't working. And to his credit, he changes tack and takes a harder stance towards Hitler. And in the end, an agreement is signed with Poland, stating that Britain and France will come to Poland's aid should its territorial integrity be threatened. So it's a hardening of the position towards Hitler. And at the same time, rearmament in Britain is stepped up, and these programs of air raid precautions, gas masks are distributed, evacuation plans are put in place. So Britain is really gearing up for a conflict.
Why did Britain and France need to give this guarantee to Poland? Was war so inevitable?
Well, it's becoming increasingly apparent that Hitler isn't going to change course, and he's carrying on with those sort of tactics he's employed before, sort of agitating for the return of what he believes is German territory, and, you know, the pretenses that he wants to provide security for German populations across Eastern Europe. Firstly in Austria, later in Czechoslovakia, and in early 1939, he's agitating over Poland, over the return of the Danzig Corridor. So it's apparent that he's not going to stop with his expansionist aims. So after the First World War, with the Treaty of Versailles, Poland is granted access to the Baltic Sea, a corridor of land leading to the port of Danzig. Danzig itself is a free city under the control of the League of Nations. So the fact that German territory is divided and it's historically Prussian territory is basically Hitler's justification for going to war over Poland and, you know, restoring what he sees as rightful German territory to the German people. In reality, he also wants to take the rest of Poland over as Lebensraum, according to his ideology. So the rhetoric coming from Hitler is making it obvious that he's not going to change tack. Appeasement relied on the fact that he'd stop sooner or later, but he's clearly not going to stop. And therefore, Britain and France have to take a harder stance. And actually, as they take that harder stance, tensions with Germany rise more and more. By probably the middle of July, the British government and the intelligence services are pretty sure that a conflict is going to break out over Poland. They can see which way the wind is blowing, and therefore preparations are put in train to react to that.
If an attempt were made to change the situation by force in such a way as to threaten Polish independence, why then, that would inevitably start a general conflagration in which this country would be involved.
So bringing it back to GCNCS in particular, what kind of preparations were they doing and what informed those?
Well, at Bletchley Park itself, actually the main improvement is in terms of communications. A big lesson of the shooting party had been the communications were poor. There were too few teleprinters. There were not enough staff to run them 24 hours a day as they needed to be run. Some of the communications with some of the ministries, such as the Air Ministry, had broken down during the Munich crisis. All that's put right over the next year at great expense. What's interesting is you can actually see this as an absence in the documentation. There are lots of complaints about communications in 1938, but in 1939, it doesn't come up at all. So clearly, those problems have all been solved.
And this is communications to the outside world. Who were they speaking to?
Firstly, it's obviously messages coming in as they're intercepted. So communications with the Y stations who are doing all this interception. And also from the commercial telegraph companies in London who are intercepting a lot of the diplomatic traffic, which is still carried by telegram, and which is still a big focus of GCNCS's work.
And I suppose sending out again as well.
After the messages are decrypted, yeah, being sent out to the customer, whether that's the ministries or the Secret Intelligence Service.
So you've mentioned communications being a lesson learned. Were there any lessons not learned that they maybe didn't take note of?
Yeah, there's a big one, which is the actual working accommodation. When W.F. Clark submits his report after the shooting party, he points out that the office space is probably too small for what they're doing, and it's also going to be too small if the staff expands. But they make do in 1938 because the staff hasn't expanded because war doesn't break out. When it comes around to 1939, that problem hasn't really been solved. So when the staff arrive at Bletchley, they have just enough space to get by. But as soon as the staff start expanding, the accommodation situation becomes critical pretty quickly. That's something that sort of fell through the cracks and maybe should have been dealt with. But it might have just been down to the fact GCNCS maybe didn't have the authority. GCNCS are the junior partner to SIS. And this might have actually led to the problems we're talking about because the GCNCS management, even if they're able to recognise that they don't have enough space for an expansion of staff, it doesn't mean they can necessarily get it changed. It might be out of their hands, but it might also be simple oversight. It's quite hard to work out where the problems come from.
This difficulty with accommodation of staff, is that why they started building the huts?
Huts are built before the outbreak of war, but we don't actually have any indication that they were planning to put codebreakers in them. that's something that happens later. My best guess is that somebody at SIS, probably Captain Ridley, had the foresight to provide more accommodation, whether it was for workmen, whether it was for recreation. We know Hut 2 was built in this period, and that was a recreation hut at Bletchley throughout the war. So chances are they were using it to relax before the war. One of the other huts that's built, the very first one, actually Hut 1, is a radio station. And this has often been called the famous Station X, which gives its name eventually to the whole site. The Y stations and some of the ministries call Bletchley Park Station X throughout the war because there is a radio station here, but Section 8 of MI6, who are running that station, move a few miles away to Warden Hall soon after the outbreak of war because, again, they need to expand. They need more space. There simply isn't space here for the whole of MI6, SIS.
Were there also issues with the numbers of staff, for example?
Well, it's quite apparent to the management that GCNCS is going to need more staff if a war breaks out, because obviously they'll have more work to do. The amount of traffic on the airwaves will probably increase. So even before the shooting party, Denniston is actually thinking about how he's going to deal with these problems. And he's a bit torn on this issue because on the one hand, he knows he'll need a reserve of staff and he wants to make sure he's got the right people ready to go when he needs them. And he's been mindful for a while that these new machine ciphers that have been introduced in the 1920s and 1930s need a different approach. The traditional classicist codebreaker isn't going to be as suited to that job as a mathematician is. So he starts looking for mathematicians from the early 30s. And those efforts sort of intensify in 1939.
So he needs a combination of the old hands that are familiar with the work and then new people with more technical skills.
Yeah, so when he brings people in, he doesn't also want to replace the old hands who know what they're doing. He's used to running quite a small, close-knit organisation where people work together effectively because they're mates and because a lot of them have a lot of experience as well. So he doesn't want to ruin his organisation by getting rid of those old hands. He wants to bring new blood into the organisation, but he doesn't also want to displace experienced staff that he's already got. So he's quite torn over the issue, as I say. He's in quite a tricky position.
Some of these old hands are quite famous names. Josh Cooper, for example.
Josh Cooper's been around since 1935, so he's actually one of the younger members of staff. You've got people like Dilly Knox, who made their name in codebreaking in the First World War, and Dilly Knox has never really stopped being at the forefront of cryptanalysis. So he's a very valuable man for Denniston. But there's also John Tiltman, there's William F. Clark, who's in charge of the naval section, another First World War veteran. Eric Earnshaw Smith, who's in charge of diplomatic. So all the heads of the different sections have vast experience, and many of their staff do as well at the lower levels. A problem that the organisation has actually had is that progression is very, very slow compared to the rest of the civil service. So there's an expectation in the civil service grades that you'll be promoted within a reasonable amount of time. But many of these people have been in GCNCS since 1919 and have never received a promotion because the places aren't opening up higher in the organisation.
And these newer types of staff, people with perhaps more technical skills or abilities, were those recruited, as you're saying, before Captain Ridley's shooting party? Did they join GCNCS at that point?
Yeah, many of them did. And they're coming from the usual source, which is the universities, mainly Oxford and Cambridge, through this sort of old boys network, which at first glance looks very, very parochial. And one would possibly assume that if the net had been cast a bit wide, better people might have been found. But they are highly qualified. They fit into the world of GCNCS very effectively. They have the right attitude to the work and the right qualifications, and in the end they perform very well. So there's definitely a certain type of person which Denniston is looking for, and that's true before the war as it is afterwards. That's one of the sort of continuities throughout this period. So in late 1939 we have this fantastic quote, Alan Bradshaw, who's the administrative officer at GCNCS, telling a representative of the Ministry of Labour that, "I think you understand that ours is a queer trade and it is hard to describe the qualities required. During the last 8 months, we have collected half a dozen unusual men who are in touch with their own world, out of which we may hope to gain further recruits when needed." And this causes a bit of friction with the Ministry of Labour, which is obviously in charge of orchestrating personnel across the entire country, throughout the entire nation. The codebreakers rely on personal contacts, and as people join the organisation, they can find more people who are of the right sort. The Ministry of Labour want to suggest people to them, but they don't really understand what GCNCS needs. In the end, the standard procedure is actually reversed. So the Bletchley staff recommend recruits and then they refer to the Ministry of Labour, who direct them through the official channels.
So they're sort of formally signed up in the Ministry of Labour after they've been headhunted already?
Exactly. So it's all backwards. So in response to this letter from Bradshaw, the Ministry of Labour lady says, "We're quite happy for you to rely on your personal contacts since you have your half a dozen unusual men. But we would like you to let us know about it before you recruit anyone so we can just make sure all the paperwork is in order." So there are these bureaucratic problems which Bletchley Park is having to deal with as they're expanding.
Now, what we're going on with this morning is the use of the respirator in a gas attack. Now, the first thing you would do is you'd hold your breath. The reason being, if you didn't hold your breath, you'd breathe in the poison gas and you'd be gassed.
Were there people recruited who were sort of told to wait for the order to arrive and then they'd be called up?
Yeah, there absolutely were. So alongside his normal recruitment, because the organisation can't grow any larger in peacetime, that was going to have to wait for war to break out, Denison also starts earmarking staff for that eventuality. They call these the emergency staff. Denison's been looking into this since 1937. In the end, Denison earmarks about 72 men. He also has about 12 women, but he puts the women in a different category as emergency clerical staff. In fact, some of those few women who actually do come to Bletchley in the end from that list are capable of doing far more than basic clerical work, and they do some of the really important code-breaking jobs. There's also a couple of people on the list who are veterans of the First World War, and especially the Room 40 operation in the Admiralty, which is where Denison had cut his teeth on code-breaking. So all these people will be brought back in the event of a war breaking out. And what's also really interesting is that during 1939, the emergency staff are trained up in the art of code-breaking. They attend some pre-war training courses. So these were quite relaxed courses, I would say. It was not particularly intensive, and there wasn't much of an institutional basis for actually training people in code breaking. Mostly it was a make it up as you go along sort of job, or learn from your colleagues. That's how it had always worked in the past. So when they put these courses on, there's a brief introduction to why they're there and what cryptography is. And they are split into different groups and went away and learned about basic techniques. You know, how a substitution cipher works, how book building works. It's all very basic stuff. And in terms of complexity, it doesn't come close to some of the work that was done at Bletchley during the war, but it gives a very basic understanding. And the assumption is, and it's a correct assumption, is that these people are smart enough that they can take those basic ideas and run with them and make new developments. And when they're faced with more complex ciphers, can build on those basic techniques into the very complex cryptanalysis that they're going to have to do later on. We have a course in January that had 9 candidates called Charlesworth, Charvet, Driver, Higham, Last, Lucas, Roberts, Turing and Wilkinson. There was another course run in March, another 9 candidates, Babbage, Cuttle, Gatty, Jenkins, Knight, Saltmarsh, Tennant, Vincent and Welshman. And just after that, another course in March, 13 candidates this time, Allen, Beeston, Campbell, Dawkins, Forster, Fraser, Lobel, Norman, Poole, Taylor, Tolkien, Waterhouse and Willoughby.
Tolkien, not the Tolkien.
Yeah, the J.R.R. Tolkien of Lord of the Rings fame.
And did he end up working at Bletchley Park?
Not in the end, no. We've got to remember, looking at some of the famous names on this list, obviously everyone knows Alan Turing is a famous cryptographer, but this is before that's happened. You know, we need to not look at this through hindsight, and in this early period, hindsight is really hard to get away from because we know what's going to happen later. But these people are not yet cryptographers. They have potential, but they haven't done it yet. Bletchley Park is not yet a famous centre of cryptography. It's a house surrounded by some huts in the Buckinghamshire countryside where not much has happened yet. And part of researching this early period is peeling back those layers of hindsight. The records are fairly patchy. A lot of the post-war histories which tell us what happened are very much written in that spirit of hindsight, and they're often written by people who weren't here at the start. We're talking about 150 staff. So many of the people who come later on have a pretty good idea of what the organisation will turn into, but they don't know what it was like before they arrived. Stuart Milner Barry writes the history of Hut 6, but he only arrives in about February 1940. So he doesn't know what happened in late 1939. And also we have to rely on personal accounts, memoirs and oral histories. But again, those are coloured by what happens later on and by the problem of hindsight. So we have to forget about all that and start from the foundations.
When you read out this list, we hear Turing, Welshman. Those aren't names that necessarily would have been particularly famous at the time.
Not massively famous, definitely not household names. They were known in their fields. Turing had obviously written on computable numbers. He was well known to be at the forefront of his field. But as a codebreaker, no. Part of the reason for putting these courses on was for the experienced codebreakers to gauge the new potential staff and decide when they might fit into the organisation. So, for example, Dilly Knox spots Alan Turing and Gordon Welshman, and he thinks they'd be a perfect fit for his Enigma research section. So that's the section they're earmarked for when they arrive later in the year.
We've focused on recruiting codebreakers here. They weren't the only staff being recruited, were they?
No, obviously an organisation like this needs a lot of basically logistical administrative support provided by female clerical staff. And what we also see in 1939 is that Denison is recruiting these in quite high numbers as well. So when it comes to the outbreak of war, probably a third of the staff have only been in GCNCS a few months. In anticipation of war breaking out, Denison is increasing the size of the organisation. He's done this previously in 1935 when the Italians invaded Abyssinia, and he did it in 1938 around the time of Munich. And usually these staff are laid off after the crisis has passed. On this occasion, obviously, they stay. So the perception of GCNCS as an organisation of very experienced old hands is not quite true, because when we look at the lower levels of the organisation, many of the staff have only been here a few months. They have to learn on the job as well. They're not as experienced, perhaps, as they might have been. It's important to stress they're doing important work. The administrative work that they're doing underpins the code breaking. Unless you're registering messages effectively, you can't work out where they're coming from or where they fit into the intelligence picture. So the work these women are doing is important, and they don't have that much experience. On the flip side, they're young, quite dynamic, they're responsive to new ideas, and that's going to actually prove a boon when war breaks out.
Were they recruited through the Ministry of Labour, or were they also through these slightly more old boy channels?
Yeah, through unofficial channels, you might say. There's an old girls network like an old boys network. So it's a matter of getting women who have the right qualifications, but are also of the right sort. Mostly that's done through family connections. And again, that seems really backwards. But you've got to remember that women who have university degrees and language qualifications as they were looking for are going to probably be quite well off, middle or upper class anyway. And from a security point of view, knowing where your staff come from is very important. So the fact that they're recruiting daughters of friends and colleagues, you know, it might be nepotism, but it's also a very effective way of finding the right sort of staff that they need.
How did you come to be here in the first place? What was your way in? How were you invited?
Got a letter from a friend, my greatest friend, actually, who had somehow got here, been invited here. And she wrote and said, "We're desperately busy, Jane. We desperately need people like you to help us. Why don't you come?"
Were you fresh from school?
Yes, fresh from school.
Yes.
And when I got here, of course, it was full of my friends, because they'd all been invited the same way. Quite extraordinary.
And was it largely because of you? You were a linguist?
I think the German thing was very influential. But I had just done a secretarial course also, so that, I suppose, was thought to be useful. And I did know a lot of the people here, and I was somebody who was prepared to come and give my life for it, which is what we all were prepared to do.
So were you interviewed in any way?
When I came? Mm-hmm. Oh, no. I mean, when I came, I was 18, and what was the point of interviewing another girl of 18 who didn't know anything about it anyway? We were lucky enough to be here at the right time, in the right place. We were able to do what we did because of that. It may be the most important thing that any of us ever done in our lives. We didn't realise it at the time, but we do now.
So with this planning, or this setting up, this recruiting, it all leads us to this one point, the outbreak of war.
Yes, absolutely. So GCNCS are ready. And by the outbreak of war, they're already at Bletchley Park working. So we actually have in the archives the move orders given to the staff at the start of August.
2nd of August, 1939. Move of service sections to war site, 15th of August, 1939. In order to carry out communication tests, the war site will be manned AM 15th August by those detailed in GCNCS first wave, who are not on leave at the time. All documents required at the war site are to be packed by 5:30 p.m. on 14th August. They will be moved during that night. As many as possible are to be placed in small cupboards and filing cabinets which can be locked. Arrangements for labelling will be promulgated later. Stationery has already been sent down. Sufficient personal luggage should be taken for 15 days.
It was decided that they'd move down to Bletchley on the 15th in order to carry out communications tests. That was the cover story for the staff at least, but let's be honest, this was a mobilisation for conflict. The plan was that just like in 1938, the first wave would move and the second wave would follow afterwards. The first wave was the free service sections, military section, air section and naval section, and the Enigma research section. So it's the same staff who would come here in 1938.
Those going by train should obtain a single ticket of the appropriate class to Bletchley. On arrival, they should place their luggage in the cloakroom, from whence it will be collected after the allocation of billets, etc. They should proceed on foot from the station to the war side, inquiring if necessary for Bletchley Park, which is on the up or west side of the railway. On leaving the station, turn right up the hill and proceed through the second lodge gates. Suitable trains from Euston are the 8:37 a.m. and the 9:30 a.m. An advance for railway tickets can be obtained from Mr. Travis. The address for official correspondence and private letters will be Room 47 Foreign Office, and the official telephone number, Whitehall 7947.
These orders are relatively mundane, telling the staff how they're going to get their documents packed up. Stationery's been sent down. They should take luggage for 15 days. Which train ticket they should buy and what they should do if they're driving, although most of them, it seems, took the train. The orders explain how expenses claims could be made and the fact all their expenses will be covered. The staff were going to be put up in hotels for the minute because until war broke out, the government hadn't actually enacted the legislation which allowed them to billet in private houses. So at the start, they're having quite a cushy time in the various hotels and inns around the Bletchley area. And on this occasion, unlike in 1938, the more prestigious staff get the more prestigious accommodation. There's also a very characteristic warning in this document about how secrecy needs to be maintained and what the cover story is for outsiders, which is that the staff are part of the Air Defence of London. As a final point, they're reminded that gas masks are to be taken.
The staff are warned against any conversations regarding the work with other members of the staff whilst in their billets. If occasion should arise as to what you are doing, the answer should be that you are part of the aerial defence of London. This test is to be treated with the utmost secrecy by all members of this department. Gas masks are to be taken.
So the staff have received this 15th of August. Where do they go? What do they do?
So they arrive at the station, they come up to the mansion. Everything's ready for them. There is furniture on this occasion, which is quite handy. They get to work as quickly as possible. We don't have much documentation of this period, which might indicate that things were a bit, administratively speaking, a bit chaotic. The staff are all working in the mansion. Work was, as usual, quite relaxed hours, considering there's going to be a war on. 10 to 6 with 1.5 hours for lunch.
So it's not 24 hours a day?
No, that all comes later.
Right.
It's quite laid back at the time. There's actually an impression that the codebreakers had to be treated well, that they were distinguished people, very clever people. And there's a perception that they shouldn't be overworked, that they'll work best if they work at a relatively relaxed pace.
So was it quite cushy? Was it relatively easy for them? Was it a pleasant place to work?
It seems like at the start, it was quite a pleasant place to work. The mansion was obviously quite a nice setting compared to an office in central London. The grounds were as yet untouched. Lovely formal gardens. There's a maze. There's a lake. There's Vahaha. There's ornamental gardens.
Do we know how many staff were here then?
Yeah, we know at this stage, 157 staff, as far as I've been able to work out, were in GCNCS, but of course they don't all come to Bletchley on the 15th of August. By the time the rest of the staff arrive, those emergency staff on the emergency list have started to be recruited as well. So it's quite hard to put an exact figure on it, but it's around 150.
On the whole, I should say that the possibility of avoiding war has not increased during the day. Government circles are in fact exceedingly pessimistic. But there is a general belief that the strategic position is improved, that Hitler is hesitating, that the Russians may betray the Germans. There is still hope that Hitler may pause and think again. There is still the possibility of a conference. The people with whom I have talked in London today certainly haven't expressed any optimism, but their spirit is better. They believe the Germans are worried and uncertain, if not frightened, and that's a pleasant situation for most Englishmen. They think, rightly or wrongly, that they now have the initiative. That if war comes, they will win it. But that if we have a conference instead, the result is likely to be only a postponement. No one could truthfully say that the alliance with Poland has ever aroused any popular enthusiasm in Britain. Britishers know very little about Poland. The necessary historic and sentimental ties are missing. But the matter is not now so much one of Poland as it is of Britain's pledged word and the determination to move in one direction or the other out of this twilight of peace. Hitler has made his demand. Now he pauses. Britain is moving up to the line, and I should be less than truthful if I fail to report that some people see it coming with almost a sense of relief. They feel that perhaps war is the only solution. I don't know. But the decision must be made. The folks here seem to think it will be made during the next 36 hours. I return you now to America.
So on the 15th of August, it all sounds rather lovely. I'm imagining this didn't continue for long.
Well, of course, tensions are still ramping up over Poland. On the 23rd of August, it's learnt that the Germans have actually signed a non-aggression pact with the Soviet Union. And that really is the nail in the coffin for sort of any sort of peace effort. It's quite clear which way the wind is blowing. This leads to a week of diplomatic to-ing and fro-ing between Berlin and London in an effort to sustain peace.
Now let's hear from the German capital, where high government officials are awaiting the arrival of the returning British ambassador. We take you now to Berlin.
The sands are running fast. Tonight, here in Berlin, we should have a decision whether it's to be peace or war. Sir Neville Henderson, the British ambassador, is due to arrive any minute now from London. The outcome of this historic meeting is now in the lap of the gods. And the entire press this evening maintains that Germany cannot and will not compromise, that the Reich will not budge an inch from its demands on Poland for the return of Danzig and the corridor. In the meantime, Germany seemed already on a complete war footing today. Housewives stood in lines beginning early this morning to get their ration cards. Cars with high army officers sped up and down the Wilhelmstrasse or down the Tiergartenstrasse to the war ministry in the Bendlerstrasse. Squadrons of big bombers have also been roaring low over the city in formation. In other words, though the talking stage has not yet been completely abandoned, the grim preparation for the worst goes on. Germany has already assured Belgium, the Netherlands, Luxembourg, and Switzerland that it will respect their neutrality in case of war. But tonight we heard that Holland had decided to mobilize. Well, all depends now on the talks between Herr Hitler and the British ambassador. This is William L. Shire, and returning you now to New York.
In this period, Hitler's trying to persuade the West that war is the last thing he wants, but the wheels have already been set in motion, and this will all come to a head on the 1st of September.
These are today's main events. Germany has invaded Poland and has bombed many towns. General mobilization has been ordered in Britain and France. Parliament was summoned for 6 o'clock this evening. Orders completing the mobilization of the Navy, Army and Air Force were signed by the King at a meeting this afternoon of the Privy Council.
The German foe begins its ruthless march of conquest. Poland's 34 million inhabitants, crushed, scattered, and enslaved. Tens of thousands of square miles of territory shrink before the movement of lightning-armored columns. Poland and the world learn the meaning of a grim new word. Blitzkrieg. The spark is set off in the free city of Danzig. Germany called it liberation. The excuse for Hitler's hordes to begin their destructive campaign of conquest. On September 1st, Danzig is incorporated into the Reich, and all Europe is aflame.
Als alter Soldat des Weltkrieges befindet sich der Führer seit Beginn des Feldzuges an der Front bei seinen Soldaten.
It is stated in London on the highest authority that if the proclamation of Herr Hitler should mean, as it would seem to mean, that Germany has declared war on Poland, Great Britain and France are inflexibly determined to fulfill to their uttermost their obligations to the Polish government.
The invasion of Poland is really a one-sided struggle. The Germans have something like a 2-to-1 superiority in manpower. They have far more tanks. They have almost total air superiority over the Poles. Nonetheless, the Poles fight very valiantly. They have a small army, but it's quite a well-equipped one. They do put up a good fight against the Germans. It's by no means a pushover, and the Germans take significant casualties. One of the advantages for the Germans the following year, when it comes to the Battle of France, is that they've had experience in Poland, and that allows them to fix a lot of problems with their armed forces. But nonetheless, it's only going to go one way. There are German columns converging on Warsaw. Britain and France honour their pact with Poland, deliver ultimatums to Germany.
The following official communique has been issued from 10 Downing Street. On September the 1st, His Majesty's ambassador in Berlin was instructed to inform the German government that unless they were prepared to give His Majesty's government in the United Kingdom satisfactory assurances that the German government had suspended all aggressive action against Poland and were prepared promptly to withdraw their forces from Polish territory, His Majesty's government in the United Kingdom would, without hesitation, fulfill their obligations to Poland. At 9 a.m. this morning, His Majesty's ambassador in Berlin informed the German government that unless not later than 11 a.m. British summer time, today, September the 3rd, satisfactory assurances to the above effect had been given by the German government and had reached His Majesty's government in London, a state of war would exist between the two countries as from that hour. His Majesty's government are now awaiting the receipt of any reply that may be made by the German government. The Prime Minister will broadcast to the nation at 11:15. That is the end of the announcement.
Arguably, Hitler didn't actually expect war over Poland. He sort of expected that Britain and France would let him get away with it like they had over Czechoslovakia. He didn't expect them to actually honour the alliance, but they do. And Britain declares war on the 3rd of September.
This is London. You will now hear a statement by the Prime Minister.
I am speaking to you from the Cabinet Room at 10 Downing Street. This morning, the British ambassador in Berlin handed the German government a final note stating that unless we heard from them by 11 o'clock, that they were prepared at once to withdraw their troops from Poland, a state of war would exist between us. I have to tell you now that no such undertaking has been received, and that consequently this country is at war with Germany. You can imagine what a bitter blow it is to me that all my long struggle to win peace has failed. Yet I cannot believe that there is anything more or anything different that I could have done and that would have been more successful. Up to the very last, it would have been quite possible to have arranged a peaceful and honourable settlement between Germany and Poland. But Hitler would not have it. He had evidently made up his mind to attack Poland, whatever happened. And although he now says he put forward reasonable proposals which were rejected by the Poles, that is not a true statement. The proposals were never shown to the Poles, nor to us. And though they were announced in the German broadcast on Thursday night, Hitler did not wait to hear comments on them, but ordered his troops to cross the Polish frontier the next morning.
But there's not much that Britain and France can do to actually help the struggle in Poland itself. The French do launch an offensive on the German border. They occupy part of the Saarland. But that's sort of a half-hearted effort, and actually the French withdraw from the ground they've captured. And in the end, Britain and France basically stand by as Poland is occupied. And their fate is sealed when on the 17th of September, the Soviet Union also invade from the east. It's a completely untenable situation. By the start of October, the fighting's all over.
With the outbreak of war, what did the response look like in Britain?
Well, the country's put on a war footing, evacuation takes place. There's this expectation that bombing's going to happen. In the end, it doesn't, and actually a lot of the evacuees return to the cities. It's an aspect of evacuation which isn't often recognised.
We're on number 12 platform at Waterloo Station, one of the 10 big metropolitan stations that are engaged today on the evacuation of London's school children. The train's in and the children are just arriving, coming along in their school groups with a banner in front saying what school they are. This lot, St John's School, Walworth, which is south of the river, and then they follow behind. The tiny tots in front, leading up to the bigger ones, the 12, 13-year-olds behind, and here comes a high school, more like 14, 15, and 16. They're being evacuated too.
There's some combat at sea. The SS Athenia is sunk by a U-boat illegally because it's an unarmed passenger ship.
I was in the third-class dining room on Sunday night on the Athenia when the loud crash of the explosion came, and the support in the dining room, which was practically beside me, came crashing down. Dishes went flying all over the place. Lights were extinguished immediately. The boat lurched to the port side and everyone went hurtling across the floor. The fumes were so thick that we thought we would be asphyxiated, and the smell was something terrible. Everyone was crying, "Oh my God!" And we never really expected to see daylight. Somehow, I will never know how, I reached the stairs. When I got up on deck, there were many dead lying around, and it wasn't very pleasant, of course. Someone finally threw me a life belt, and a man helped me put it on. A rope ladder was thrown overboard, and I was just about 6 feet from the water when I noticed that the ladder was tangled at the bottom, and I could not possibly proceed any further. The man above was practically on top of my hands all the time, and I was wondering how much longer I could hang on, dangling in the air, when a man who was in the lifeboat flung me a rope, which I managed to slide down. There were 30 or 35 people in the boat, and we were just ready to push off when we saw a woman struggling in the water. We finally got her into the boat, although it was found that she had broken her arm. As we were pushing off, we saw several women coming down a rope ladder, but they slipped right into the water and I suppose were dashed against the side of the boat. I never saw them after that. It seemed a lifetime until we were finally picked up. I was so exhausted and weak that I had to be helped onto the boat and just flopped down and had to make the best of things.
117 people are killed. The Germans decry all responsibility and actually put about the story that Churchill has staged the whole thing. The truth didn't come out until actually the Nuremberg trials at the end of the war, when Dönitz finally admits that the Kriegsmarine were responsible.
The German Admiralty tonight issued another denial that a German submarine had sunk the Athenia. It stated no German submarines were in the vicinity at the time. The press here today, as yesterday, continues to accuse Mr. Churchill of sinking the Athenia himself. This is William L. Shire in Berlin, returning you to Columbia in New York.
And within GCNCS, what were the consequences there?
Well, we have a hint of what took place due to a memorandum which survives in the archives. It's a very interesting document, but it's quite a tricky document because you have to read between the lines. It's from Denniston to Stuart Menzies, who's at this point deputy head of SIS, but he's going to later be the director. Denniston has many, many complaints about how things are going at Bletchley Park. He talks about how GCNCS has been forced into disintegration by the fact that the first wave has had to come to Bletchley Park on its own. And he talks about discontent in staff, about the conditions of work. He complains about the fact members of SIS have official cars, whereas the codebreakers haven't got any official transport and they're having to provide each other lifts, basically carpool into work every day from their hotels, which some of which are many miles away. So he says there's a real spirit of discontent growing among my colleagues. And then he lays out some improvements which he would like to see in how things are organised. Talks about how sections are actually being forced out of the mansion into the huts. So this is the first indication we have that the huts are being occupied by the codebreakers. And it talks about how naval section in the library conditions are grossly overcrowded. And we know that actually staff are having to work on the floor. They haven't got enough tables and chairs for all the people in the room. And it's also been necessary to requisition the local school, Elmer's School, for some of the staff coming up from London. And Denniston complains that it takes 20 minutes to walk there, and walking backwards and forwards on a dark winter's afternoon is not going to make for efficiency. And he even says that it's impossible to use the telephone because the rooms are so overcrowded.
September 12th, 1939. My dear Mingus, I'm sending you herewith a memorandum which Travis and I have drafted, as I had the Admiral's permission to discuss administrative details with you. The whole question will shortly become so acute that it will have to be laid before him for decision. But in the meantime, I wish to make you fully aware of the present position and of future requirements. In addition to the present policy, which has forced GC and CS into disintegration, which I have always held to lead to a real loss of efficiency, I take the opportunity of repeating to you the discontent in the staff of GC and CS, which is now becoming increasingly vocal, with the actual conditions of work. The contention is that GC and CS, a civil service organisation, was moved out of London by orders of the Admiral, and not by orders of the Foreign Office, our administrative head, and that therefore the GC and CS must receive equality of treatment with the SIS, who are also moved by the Admiral's order. Travis and myself and senior assistants now occupied far less senior positions in the service, and many of our recruits are men of considerable distinction, and it is definitely felt that in the allocation of accommodation, such facts should be taken into account. It appears to me improper to invite such as these to try to do work requiring a high degree of concentration in overcrowded rooms. Again, the question of billeting, which Captain Ridley has carried out with such tact in the face of difficulty, has forced staff to live many miles from their work, and the question of transport is involved. It is felt that official cars can be made available from members of SIS, but GC and CS has had to raise a force of volunteers from among its own members, and ask them to give their time and their cars to help their colleagues. In fine weather, it's hard for a man who has had a heavy day to forego his leisure for this. In the dark evenings to come, it will be even harder. If there are not sufficient official cars to do this duty, would it not be possible to engage the WVS to deal with the transport of the staff between office and billets? I have done a great deal and will do all I can to maintain the spirit of cooperation, but there is a real spirit of discontent growing among my colleagues. I have congratulated them on the good work that is being done under very trying conditions, and the natural reply is, improve our conditions and you will get more results. The few days that have elapsed since the outbreak of war are sufficient to show that we may hope very soon to contribute intelligence of a definite military value to the fighting services. If, however, we are to function efficiently, we must be reasonably housed. These are the main considerations. 1. Cooperation between the three service sections is essential. 2. All sections should be in close proximity to the teleprinter room, for a great part of the raw material used by all sections is transmitted from the Y stations and some of the cable offices. It should be remembered that the Foreign Office agreed to spend £4,000 a month to ensure this rapid means of communication for its own ultimate advantage. I have always viewed with very grave concern the fact that the military section has been moved to the garden to make room for mess, which is used for 1 hour per day, and the air section is also being moved away from the teleprinters to make way for a registry. The air section should be right on top of the teleprinters in the naval section, with whom it may have to confer urgently and frequently. The section working on the machine problem is in number 3 cottage, and development there is becoming much more hopeful. And here again, they require very close cooperation with the section for whom they are working. The diplomatic and commercial sections are in St. Helmer's School. Although these sections are called diplomatic, certain of them require collaboration with the service sections, and produce a matter of military importance. 20 minutes spent walking backwards and forwards on a dark winter's afternoon is not going to make for efficiency. Further, the naval section is now grossly overcrowded, and we have to remember that we have added to our staff volunteers of very considerable standing, and the research work they will undertake is of extreme national importance, and one which calls for some degree of comfort in their surroundings, in order to get the best out of them. It must be remembered that the 3 weeks we have been here have been remarkably fine, and the walking about has been pleasant, if wasteful. With dark afternoons and evenings and cold conditions, people will hesitate to walk out in the open considerable distances to confer with their colleagues. In our overcrowded state, the use of the telephone, never satisfactory, is impossible. It seems that there is not room to house SIS and GC and CS in Bletchley Park efficiently. The only alternative, therefore, is to separate. It appears to be most difficult to move the teleprinters and provide lines for them, and it therefore remains to examine whether alternative accommodation can be found for some or all sections of SIS.
What's interesting about this correspondence is that neither Denniston nor Menzies actually mention what's caused all these problems. But if you read between the lines, you can sort of work it out. What's happened is the war has broken out and the rest of the Secret Service have turned up at Bletchley Park, their secret war station. So the codebreakers have previously been left to their own devices. They've had plenty of space. They've been able to use the upstairs rooms in the mansion for their own quiet working. Now spooks have turned up. They've got big official cars and they have actually housed their chauffeurs in the upstairs rooms of the mansion. They've forced GCNCS into smaller and smaller offices. They've got their own registry, which is going in the room where Air Section was, so Air Section are having to move into the huts. They're causing all sorts of problems. And so that's what's really triggered this. And this is why Denniston, as polite a man as he is, lets out a certain amount of dissatisfaction over the situation, which is quite uncharacteristic of him. Normally, he's a very difficult man to annoy.
That's interesting you say that, because Denniston certainly has suffered in the past from pretty critical representation. In The Imitation Game, he was portrayed by Charles Dance as sort of a gruff and quite an unpleasant character. Is that just simply not true?
I think that's a very unfair way of representing him. He was certainly a much nicer man than he's portrayed in the film. He's a family man. He's friendly. He gets on well with people, and he's a good people person. And the way he runs the organisation is as a people person. So he likes to know who everyone is, and he wants everyone, as I said, to be friends and to cooperate. Denniston likes to run the organisation in quite a close-knit, collegiate way. As the organisation grows, that's going to cause problems because it needs to be run in a more hard-nosed way. But he understands the character of the unusual men who he's employing. He understands the need to give them freedom and allow them to improvise.
And as you say, close cooperation between the sections, but also physical proximity as well.
Yeah, so he's actually really worried about being spread out into the huts because he knows the entire organisation is dependent on the teleprinter. That's their lifeline to the outside world. That's where they get their material and where they send on their product. And he also knows that all the different sections benefit from cooperating with each other. And the organisation at this stage is very loose, and it's possible for staff to be, you know, lent and borrowed between different sections. So Denniston doesn't want to impinge on that by spreading people out into different buildings. But it's something he has to accept in the end. Denniston's reaction to these problems that are happening with the arrival of SIS actually shows us something else about his character, which is he's not massively politically savvy, because his first suggestion is, why don't SIS go back to London? And Admiral Sinclair is unlikely to accept that his secret war station is going to be taken over by GCNCS and everyone else can go back to London. So that doesn't go anywhere. In the end, after a bit of toing and froing, it's decided that more huts are going to be built. They're actually going to be connected by pneumatic tubes. And this is an inkling of what's going to happen later on with the industrialisation of the site. They're thinking about the best way to house the staff so that they can cooperate effectively. But this is the genesis of that sort of hut building effort, which we all know so well. And huts 5 through to 7 are built by the end of the year. But he's torn between keeping everyone close together so they can cooperate, but also keeping them far enough apart that they have the space to do their work. That's the sort of classic organisational problem which managers in large organisations will be able to appreciate. Reading these documents by and about Denniston, you really get an impression that he's a very reasonable man. He's a very personable man. He's very good at managing people. And those interpersonal skills really benefited the organisation in the earlier days. And he also oversees the recruitment effort, which is vital to putting GCNCS in a state where it can make those important breakthroughs in cryptography that will make such a contribution to the war effort. So all in all, we see that the impression given in the film is quite an unfair one, to say the least.
Now, I get the impression here in Berlin that the people have pretty well recovered from the first shock of Britain and France coming into this war. People thought that with the two big Western powers in, they would see terrible air raids and all that. But with the best part of the week gone by, at least those in Berlin has seen neither enemy planes, nor bombs, nor even leaflets, nor have they heard anything about an attack on the West Front. The only war news they've had is about the victorious counterattack, as it's called here, against Poland. I thought the faces of those on the streets were therefore a little bit brighter today. As to the blockade, I don't think the average German has thought about it yet. The Minister of Interior tonight ordered all British citizens to report to the police within 24 hours, and after that, they may not leave town without police permission. But note that the order does not apply to the French. The Germans still seem to put the French on a different footing from the British. I don't know why, but they do.
So they've earmarked emergency staff. What happens when they arrive?
After war breaks out, they start to come in dribs and drabs. Nigel de Grey, who's one of these First World War veterans, who's very central to the management of the organisation, says they arrive with the slightly unexpected effect of carrier pigeons. It's a common story told about Bletchley Park that the emergency staff got a telegram saying Auntie Flo is not so well, and then they knew to come to the war station. I can't say this is untrue, but I've not seen any evidence of it. And another reason to be a bit suspicious of it is the fact that this would involve telling them where Bletchley Park was, and this is a top secret war station. What's most likely is that they got a message, like the way most staff are recruited, they got a message saying, come to Bletchley at such and such time and we'll meet you at the station. And then they would take them up to the site.
So were all the staff on the emergency list called up in the end?
No, in the end, actually, a lot of them weren't. So there were over 70 staff on the list and only 42 of them ever worked at Bletchley Park. So we have people like Tolkien, who decided that he would rather go and write The Lord of the Rings than come and work here. A lot of the emergency reserve weren't actually called up. This is part of Denison's recruitment policy, not to fill the staff with people he considers amateurs and kind of dilute the expertise of the workforce. He wants to recruit very selectively and allow people who've arrived to learn their trade. And the other factor is that there's a lot of other government departments also recruiting who might give a better offer. At the end of the day, Denison can't force these people to come and work here. So a lot of them are recruited by various other government departments. The Ministry of Information, that's a particularly attractive one. And others say, I'll come along, but I need 6 months to finish whatever I'm working on at the moment. One chap, Martin Charlesworth, who's at Cambridge, decides he wants to stay at Cambridge, but he actually stays there as a sort of a recruitment agent, and he sends more people on to Bletchley.
Didn't he recruit Harry Hinsley and was it Bill Bonsall?
He did. So it's quite odd to think about how Denison and GCNCS went to all this effort to draw up this big list of people and train some of them in cryptography and didn't actually recruit most of them. But it just shows you how cautious they were about preserving the organisation as it existed before the war, not allowing it to be taken over by amateurs who didn't really know what they were doing.
All cinemas, theatres and other places of entertainment are to be closed immediately until further notice. In the light of experience, it may be possible to allow the reopening of such places in some areas. They are being closed because if they were hit by a bomb, large numbers would be killed or injured. Sports gatherings and all gatherings for purposes of entertainment and amusement, whether outdoor or indoor, which involve large numbers congregating together, are prohibited until further notice. This refers especially to gatherings for purposes of entertainment. But people are earnestly requested not to crowd together unnecessarily in any circumstances. Churches and other places of public worship will not be closed.
The other thing that happens after the outbreak of war is the second wave start to come up from London. And these are the what we call the civil sections, working on diplomatic and commercial traffic. Most of GCNCS's focus in the interwar period had actually been on diplomatic traffic. And it had been stipulated in the 1919 Official Secrets Act in a secret clause that the cable companies would give copies to GCNCS for decryption.
When you say diplomatic traffic, what do you mean? Different countries' diplomats?
So, yeah, the diplomatic section is split into subsections that cover most countries in the world. The only major countries they're not focusing on in this period are Germany and the Soviet Union. But the diplomatic traffic of Italy, of Japan, France, America.
GCNCS are reading all of this?
Yeah, they're reading as much of it as they can, mostly. They understand diplomatic codes quite well. They're reading all Italian diplomatic traffic, for example. The German systems are more complex. The Russians are using one-time pads because it had been given away in the 1920s that their codes were being broken. So they upgraded their systems.
And one-time pads are completely uncrackable.
Yeah, they are. Theoretically, unless you have the very one-time pad, you can't crack the message. And you're only meant to use the pad once. So unless something goes very badly wrong, it should be uncrackable. There's also the commercial section who are working on, you know, predictably enough, commercial codes. This was set up in 1938. It mainly focused on big Japanese firms at the start because it was believed that if a war broke out in the Far East and codebreakers weren't able to get into the diplomatic traffic or the military traffic, the traffic of big firms might actually be a way to find out what's happening in Japan. And most of this is encrypted in quite basic commercially available ciphers. So they're going to stop a cursory onlooker from reading your traffic, but they're not going to stop codebreakers of the caliber of GCNCS. When war breaks out, commercial sections start focusing on German traffic, and that actually proves very important in the early war period for the work of the Ministry of Economic Warfare. which is interested in blockading Germany and in trying to damage the German economy in any way possible. So they're interested in traffic that gives them a good picture of how the blockade is working, and especially if any neutral ships are carrying cargo for German companies. It said in late 1939 that the commercial section of the school is doing invaluable work in regard to contraband control. So they make an important contribution to that economic effort against Germany in the early period of the war, which is an angle of code breaking that most people might not have heard of. And they're one of the sections which grows the quickest. They start off with 9 people, and by the end of the year, they've got about 150. Their main problem is they've got too much traffic and they're having to decide what to decrypt. They can read all of it fairly easily, but they've just got too much. And that's why they have to take on so many more staff, is to get through the massive backlog of messages they've got and work out what's important and what's not. So really, their problem is not a cryptanalytical one, it's administrative. Initially, they were housed in the school, but as the section grew, because the main service sections were low on space, it was decided to send the commercial section back to London. So they go back to London in November 1939.
For an analysis of today's news of the European situation, Columbia now presents H.V. Kaltenborn, distinguished news analyst. Mr. Kaltenborn.
Good evening, everybody. Let's begin with Romania. General George Argeșanu, commander of the Bucharest Army Corps and former Minister of War, tonight was named Premier, replacing the slain Prime Minister Armand Călinescu. Russian armies are menacing from the north. German armies are menacing from the west. Logically, and adventure in Romania is the next step for both Russia and Germany. Germany needs the oil, needs the wheat that Romania has. Russia remembers that Romania, after the war, took her province of Bessarabia, and it's perfectly natural to assume that perhaps, beyond their agreement on Poland, that Stalin and Hitler have also arrived at an agreement with respect to Romania. It is quite possible that the events in Romania today are the first planned step in whatever Germany and Russia intend to do. Both the British and the French governments have evidently deemed it of considerable importance to answer Adolf Hitler's address. The British government answered once again today, pointing out the inconsistencies and what it calls the lies of Adolf Hitler. And this afternoon, Edouard Daladier speaks in answer to Hitler.
So the second wave has arrived, diplomatic, commercial sections. What were the other sections doing?
Well, they're doing actually relatively little. We might assume that they start off at full speed reading German codes and ciphers. Well, very little German is actually readable. Germany has very tough systems, and it's actually an opinion that since the Germans know their codes were read in the First World War, most famously with the Zimmermann telegram, they're not going to let it happen again. So they're actually quite sceptical whether any German materials can be read. Their diplomatic ciphers can't be broken into. Their military material is almost all on Enigma. And at this stage of the war, it seems like Enigma is going to be very, very tough to crack. There's more success against Italian codes. A naval section especially is making a big effort against the Italian Navy.
So the Italians weren't using Enigma?
The Italians were using Enigma in their Navy, but it was a more basic version than the German military Enigma. It didn't have the plug board, so it's a much simpler machine. And Dilly Knox had actually worked out how to read that in the 1930s. So the naval section are able to read quite a bit of naval traffic. They're also doing more basic, what we would later call traffic analysis sort of methods. So they have people doing direction finding, and they have staff whose sole job is to plot out the movements of ships on maps. They're looking at traffic volumes, things like that, to work out what the Italian fleet is doing.
The Italian traffic that was being intercepted, did that give information on the movements and activities of some of the other countries as well? The Germans, for example, who they couldn't read?
Not really. The codebreakers aren't really able to give much intelligence about what the Germans are doing at all. So, for example, they don't see the invasion of Poland coming. Looking at the naval side of the war, the Battle of the River Plate that happens in late 1939 comes as a complete surprise to the British ships involved. They think they're fighting the Scheer and they're fighting the Graf Spee, because Bletchley Park haven't been able to tell them that these ships are in the South Atlantic or where they are. So the sort of very detailed operational naval intelligence that's going to come out of Bletchley Park in the next few years is not something that they're capable of doing.
So it's not, for example, where we've seen in the programmes we've done about D-Day, where information was being gleaned about the Germans from intercepting Japanese traffic. It wasn't that case here.
No, that wasn't something they were able to do at that stage in the war. The most sort of cryptologically successful section is actually air section. because apart from the Luftwaffe ground traffic, which is on the Enigma machine, their air-to-ground or air-to-air traffic can be understood.
So rather than the direction-finding successes they were getting elsewhere, it's more the message content that was really valuable then?
Yeah, the Luftwaffe use codebooks to encrypt their air-to-ground traffic. The way it works is you look up your word or phrase in your daily key sheet, and this turns your word or phrase into a three-digit number. And then you look up that three-digit number in your codebook, and your codebook doesn't change very often. I think the Luftwaffe used the same codebook for the first few years of the war. The codebook turns your three-digit number into a three-letter code, and then you transmit those three-letter codes, and at the other end, you turn the three-letter code back into numbers and back into your message. So this is a system that's relatively easy to read once you've reconstructed the codebook. At that point, you just need to do the daily key sheet, and you can work out by looking at patterns in the message traffic and working out which unit is talking to which other unit, looking at the context of the messages, how those three-digit numbers relate to the codebook. So the air section work on these codes is actually very interesting because it's not all done at Bletchley. Partly it's done at the Air Ministry Y station at Cheadle, and a system is put in place where a lot of the day-to-day decoding is done by a group of people at Cheadle who are called computers, because computers aren't a thing. They are people who compute, so they're known as computers with an O, and they do the day-to-day code breaking. So that allows the Y station operators to give intercepted messages straight to the computers. The computers do the decryption, and the intelligence can go straight on to fighter command or whoever needs it. Whereas the longer-term research work that can't be done at the Y station for lack of resources is done at Bletchley Park. So that's a system that actually sounds really counterintuitive, but it works very effectively for air section. They're able to understand how the German codes work. They're able to reconstruct the code books. The problem they have is mainly because they don't know enough about the German Air Force. They don't know how many planes they've got. They don't know how it's organized. They don't know how the call sign system works. So a lot of the messages they can read, but they don't have the context to turn them into useful intelligence. So adding that context is going to be, you know, the main challenge for air section in the first year or two of the war.
It sounds like it's all running very smoothly. But Bletchley was trying to do decryption. Cheadle was doing decryption. There was a little bit of tension. Was this the bit in history where Josh Cooper then says, I think the Cheadle boys can handle this, and passes it over to them?
Yeah. The system works smoothly once they've got it in place. The process of putting that system in place is not smooth. Another problem in this early period is that the framework for disseminating the intelligence doesn't really exist. GCCS is still a department which is meant to do cryptography for the various different services that they can't do themselves. So they decrypt it and they send it back to whichever ministry. They're not an intelligence center. There's not really a framework for bringing all the intelligence gained from those decrypts into one place and drawing conclusions from it. It's to be done somewhere else. That's something that will change.
The British Empire and the French Republic have been at war with Nazi Germany for a month tonight. Directions have been given by the government to prepare for a war of at least 3 years. That does not mean that victory may not be gained in a shorter time. How soon it will be gained depends upon how long Herr Hitler and his group of wicked men, whose hands are stained with blood and soiled with corruption, can keep their grip upon the docile, unhappy German people. It was for Hitler to say when the war would begin. But it is not for him or for his successors to say when it will end. It began when he wanted it, and it will end only when we are convinced that he has had enough. We may remember the words of old John Bright after the American Civil War was over, when he said to an audience of English working folk, at last, after the smoke of the battlefield had cleared away, the horrid shape which had cast its shadow over the whole continent had vanished and was gone forever.
The Italians were using Enigma, but you said that it didn't have a plugboard so that it was possible to read it. What about the other Enigma traffic that they couldn't read yet?
Well, at the start of the war, the German Enigma, because it has that plugboard, is too difficult to read. But actually, things have moved in a very positive direction just before the war breaks out, because a meeting has taken place with the Polish codebreakers at the Piri Forest near Warsaw. Knox and Denison have gone over there, not expecting much, but what they've learned is that the Poles have been reading Enigma, And therefore, there's a hope that the British are going to be able to do the same. And we're going to talk about this in a lot more detail in a subsequent episode. But what's important for now to recognise is that Bletchley Park develops with the prospect of reading Enigma in mind. And a lot of the early developments are focused on not just the cryptanalytical effort against Enigma, but also putting together the organisation which will allow the intelligence gained from it to be used in the most beneficial possible way.
When you say about the organisation developing, can you give us a bit more information about that?
Sure. So when GCNCS comes to Bletchley Park, its main focus is on the free service sections. But by the end of the year, it's actually been decided that a big new addition to the organisation is going to be created, which is the Enigma Decryption and Processing Complex, as I might call it. And very early in 1940, we have the establishment of HUT 6 to do the decryption and HUT 3 to do the analysis of the intelligence. And that is a framework that's going to prove very, very successful. And it's going to become the focus of the entire organisation, of the sort of, if you can picture it as a sort of web, HUT 6 and HUT 3 there at the centre of the web. And it's an organisation that's going to persist for the rest of the war. So that is the one really big development which takes place in the first few months of the war. And it's not a cryptanalytical development so much as an organisational one. I think you can sum up this early period in terms of two words, evolution and revolution. And there's aspects of both. In an evolutionary sense, the organisation carries on largely as it had before the war. You know, Denison's management style is a continuation, and he's concerned with taking on staff who are of the right sort, a similar sort to people he'd been recruiting beforehand, and he wants to integrate them into the organisation rather than tearing down and starting from scratch. So there's a definite continuity there. Many of the early efforts are overseen and contributed to by people who've been in GCNCS since the 20s and 30s. But there's also this revolutionary aspect with the creation of the Enigma Processing Centre, because the organisation is gearing up to do something which it's never managed to do before and which no cryptographic bureau in the world has managed to do before, which is break the top-level ciphers of the enemy and not just read them, but also manage the intelligence derived from them in a centralised, totalising way, which will provide the Allies with an extremely powerful weapon when it comes to actually winning the war.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.